For the 2 weeks we were in camp, didn't read a newspaper, didn't turn on the radio, did not have a clue what was even going on in the world. It's amazing how your focus narrows down just to the activities that you participate in, and everything else just like doesn't seem honestly to exist. As usual, we head home and you turn on the radio and you begin to see what's going on around the world. I found out that the Middle East was the same as it had been when I left, but that the stock market had rather dramatically changed. That the stock market, as we had left, had been plunging almost dramatically. In fact, I think the total point drop over a period of a couple weeks there was about 1,500 points in the Dow. And I wanted to read part of an article that was out of USA Today regarding the market and some of the impact that had on the psyche of people in this nation and around the world. So since the latest bear market rout began in May, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has plunged 25%. Stock investors have lost $2.6 trillion. How many dollars is that? I mean, nobody knows what a trillion is. There's no way to measure that in our comprehension, honestly. Most of the bleeding has occurred in the past 2 weeks, basically while we were at camp, as the average lost 1,490 points. And then it mentions drops of 390 points and 235 points in a single day. Many investors have lightened up their stock holdings or just hanging in for the long term, figuring the market must be near a bottom. But the latest plunge has caused a new and alarming group of investors to emerge, those who have lost faith in the market completely. They're throwing in the towel, pulling their money out of the market, and walking away, possibly for good. The comment goes on to reflect that people, in some cases, have lost faith that the system is even working anymore, that they simply aren't in it and they don't feel safe to be there anymore. Sometime back in a sermon, I couldn't find it in my notes, but I remember mentioning Mr. Armstrong years ago, back in 1920, going to a business luncheon. And he listened to Roger Babson speak, who advised the men there in the luncheon in terms of what the economy was in his day. It was listed in Mr. Armstrong's autobiography. Mr. Babson ran a business and investment firm. He was very, very successful, made millions of dollars off of the services of offering those firms advice to banks and other institutions and investors. And he was speaking there. He was an author. He was an educator. He had started what is today a college, back then was a business administration school, where the students would go and literally have a desk, a phone, a dictaphone, a typewriter. They had secretaries typing up their assignments and up their correspondence, and he tried to bring in people and teach them how to be a leader and executive in the business world. So he was very successful, recognized in his time, and he began to speak to the group in 1920. And what he said was he warned them that they were headed for a serious economic decline. That decline was realized in 1921 and 1922 when many businesses went broke. Corn, in particular, in terms of just a commodity, during that period of time went from $1.18 to 18 cents a bushel. Obviously, the farmers weren't buying tractors, they weren't buying equipment, they were feeding horses the grain and things that they could raise. And again, the economy just kind of temporarily evaporated and shrunk down largely and disappeared. Mr. Babson later explained in the midst of that downturn what it was that he had looked at to see what was coming. He said that he didn't just look at the business indexes that were in place. The bankers looked at those, the other stock investors looked at those. He said, but what he looked at, in addition to the business indexes, he looked at the way the people as a whole were dealing with each other and what he defined as righteousness. Now, that was his term, righteousness. But the way people dealt with each other, and he looked at that as a factor as well. And he believed that when 51% or more of the people were reasonably righteous in their business dealings with each other, as he used that term, that you were headed for increasing prosperity. And when 51% of the people became unrighteous in their business dealings, that there was going to be an economic decline. And so in addition to the market reports, he looked at the business dealings of the people, and he predicted an economic decline. Now, you could write that off as, well, okay, he got lucky once and he hit it, but the fact is, he was the first financial forecaster to predict the collapse of the stock market in 1929 and the depression that followed. He was the first one out of the blocks. He predicted it again based on the righteousness of the people. In the World News and Prophecy of July of this current year, we have an article that leads out, "Greed is the News of the Day," and it mentions some of the issues in the stocks and the economy and the business dealings of our time. He says, last November, Enron, the Houston, Texas-based energy company, collapsed almost overnight when accounting fraud overestimated profits by $600 million. The stock drastically dropped in value, thousands lost jobs, and millions of dollars were lost by investors, both large and small. I got a call from a friend in Houston this morning, called just to say hi and see what I was doing, and we chatted for a little bit, and I asked her about Houston and what was going on, and she said, you know, there are thousands of people who have lost their jobs. There are $200,000 and $300,000 homes that people are literally just walking away from. They can't pay for them. They can't make the payments. He said there's an unbelievable climate of frustration and despair among people that were involved in that. People lost their life savings, their investments. They lost their retirement. They lost their seniority. They lost their security. They lost their homes. It was just a huge collapse. And she just said the impact down there is massive. Arthur Anderson, this is going back to World News and Prophecy, Arthur Anderson, Enron's auditor, lost business and credibility when it was revealed that documents were shredded in order to cover up major bookkeeping mistakes. I think we're being rather generous when we use the term mistakes here in the article. Anderson was one of America's largest and most respected firms. Arthur Anderson used to do the Worldwide Church of God books. And we always said, remember, they were part of the Big Seven. That was prestige. They were looking at our accounting, and therefore our accounting was flawless because we had one of the biggest and the best. Its fall is part of a mounting credibility gap spreading over much of corporate America. In late June, WorldCom, the second largest long-distance company in the United States, anybody here use MCI? MCI is owned by WorldCom. Let me know if you need a phone. I'll loan you one from AT&T, which we use. Admitted that the company had claimed regular operating expenses as capital expenses over five consecutive quarters in 2001 and 2. This allowed the heavily indebted company to overstate earnings by $3.8 billion. I mean, $3.8 billion, one company. Overstatement, not just saying that that was all the mistake that was in place. The U.S. Justice Department will launch a criminal investigation against WorldCom, and the company is laying off 17,000 people, or 28% of its staff, because of corruption, because of malfeasance, because of simply greed and selfishness in the business community environment that was taking place. Article from New York Times, Citigroup said to mold deal to help Enron skirt the rules. So now we have banks that are getting involved saying, well, they're not saying, this is coming out, but we're finding out that there's banks that set up the deals that allowed companies like Enron to do the accounting bookkeeping shenanigans they did by saying, well, look, your auditor approves it, and we'll help you by loaning you the money. Of course, they had off-balance sheet financing. Enron actually had to cancel one of the executive committees on ethics in order to be able to make the business deals at the board level that they made. They had to get rid of the ethics committee or something of that nature because they had to be exempt from being policed by their own system for these things to take place. Another article that comes out says Citigroup, this is from just off the Yahoo News Service, Citigroup, J.P. Morgan marketed Enron-type deals to other firms. And so now we have, again, there's another bank brought in. And not only are they setting this up for Enron, But because it worked so well for Enron and there was so much financial gain to be realized, they began to market these packages on financing on how to set up your company so that the company won't actually show your assets on your books and your expenses are not accounted for and you can actually pocket the money and run. And so now we have major accounting firms, major world-renowned banks, and some of the largest business corporations in this country all kind of wrapping together. I'll pay you, you pay me, I'll hand you, and you hand back to me. And so what you begin to see is an atmosphere of corruption and decline that is actually epidemic as we see it taking now place. And you can understand then why people have lost faith in the economic system, temporarily at least, because they don't trust and believe that the information they're giving is actually based on the facts. Roger Babson was a very religious man. He applied to the church the same principles that he looked at in business, and he believed very strongly in cause and effect. And he looked at it this way. When the church community is moral, then the church community realizes success and progress. And when the church community is immoral, then the community itself goes into decline. He believed the very same laws that he saw operating in business based on Newton's law, third law of motion, for every action there's an opposite and opposing equal reaction. And so he believed that law could be applied to business, and he believed that law could also be applied to the church. He predicted the crash of 21 and 22. He predicted the crash of 29 and the depression that followed based on those principles. Fact is, Roger Babson was right. Roger Babson was right. While we were gone to camp, I got behind in the Bible reading program, which seems to be my proclivity. I have to go in spurts to catch up, and I'm caught up actually a couple days ahead, but it took a chunk of yesterday's reading to go through. But it was interesting to go through a section of Deuteronomy all in one piece, as compared to maybe reading day by day, to go through a block of it all at one time. One of the things that jumped out at me as I was catching up yesterday was the impact that God said there would be of his people's obedience and their disobedience. Repeatedly, he was telling them, if you do good, it will go well with you. If you do bad, you're not going to believe what will happen. It is not going to be nice. So do good. I'm with you. I'm helping you. But you must make that choice. And he reinforced that under the blessings and cursings in different ways at different times. There is cause and effect. But cause and effect is not just like if you're speeding down the road and there's a policeman, you might get a ticket. It's not just like that. Cause and effect under God as his people is in part, if you're speeding down the road, God might even go get a policeman for our benefit to get our attention, so that we might back off and humble ourselves again before him. God's hand is actively involved. It isn't just time and chance. Notice Deuteronomy 11 in verse number 8 in this respect. We can be grateful that God loves us enough to actually impact the choices we make in a specific conscious way. That he will not just let us veer off and wander off into Never Never Land without him stopping and catching our attention to bring us back. It says, you shall keep, Deuteronomy 11, verse 8, every commandment which I command you this day, that you may be strong and go in and possess the land which you cross over to possess, and that you may prolong your days in the land which the Lord swore to give your fathers, to them and their descendants, a land flowing with milk and honey. For the land which you go to possess is not like the land of Egypt from which you have come, where you sowed your seed, watered it by foot as in a vegetable garden. They could bring and open the gates to the irrigation canals from the Nile River with their foot, and the water would pour in, and the Nile was always there, and they could water their crops at some level no matter what in Egypt. God didn't want Israel in a place like that, because in a place like that, you could worship bulls and ignore God. You could build pyramids and have mysteries and priests that worship the sun and ignore God. And so God actually put his people in a land where they couldn't ignore him for long, because it required God's hand to bring the rain for the crops and the sustenance of Canaan. And so God put Israel where they would be dependent on him and where he could more consciously and directly intervene. But the land you cross over to possess is a land of hills and valleys, which drinks water from the rain of heaven. A land for which the Lord your God cares means he doesn't just say he cares about it, he's affectionate toward it. It means he takes care of it, a land that he actually maintains. The eyes of the Lord your God are always on it from the beginning of the year to the very end of the year. And it shall be that if you diligently obey my commands, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God and serve him with all your heart and with all your soul, then I will give you the rain for your land in its season, the early rain, the latter rain, that you may gather in your grain, your new wine, and your oil, and I will send grass in your fields for your livestock, that you may eat and be filled. Take heed to yourselves, lest your heart be deceived, and you turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. Lest the Lord's anger be aroused against you, and he shut up the heavens so that there be no rain, and the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord is giving you. I've mentioned before, and you know the story, of basically how Michelle's womb was closed when we were married for like 7 years before Megan was born. And how it was through meeting and being willing to meet and then accept my son, which was then our firstborn son, where God then opened her womb and allowed us to have Megan and then Derek. Does God close wombs today? Well, he sure did with us. If you told somebody that, maybe they would say, well, that's ridiculous. How could you say that? Does God cause sickness or bring sickness or allow sickness or create or produce sickness on people today? Well, is God the same yesterday, today, and forever? Or has God somehow changed fundamentally and doesn't operate as he once did? Well, just read what he says. He'll shut up the heavens, there'll be no rain, the land yield no produce, and you perish quickly from the good land which the Lord has given you. I realize this is given to national Israel, and that doesn't apply exactly to us in the way that it applied to them, because they functioned as a nation in a land, God as their king. But God still works with his people in this specific way. He said, therefore you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, bind them as a sign on your hand, they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall teach them to your children, speaking of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up, and you shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. It just means to have this before you, to live this way, to think about these things, to use these in your relationships, in your marriage, in your business decisions, in raising your children, in your work. That your days and the days of your children may be multiplied in the land which the Lord sware to your fathers to give them, like the days of heaven above the earth. Now let me go a little further. For if you carefully keep all these commandments which I have commanded you to do, to love the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways and hold fast to him, then the Lord will drive out all these nations from before you, and you will dispossess greater and mightier nations than yourselves. Do you have any enemies? Do you have those who oppose you? Do you have those who wish you evil? God says it's not for you to avenge those things. It is for God to avenge those things according to his choice and his wisdom and his mercy. But God does indeed avenge his people. He says, every place on which the sole of your foot treads shall be yours. From the wilderness and Lebanon, from the river Euphrates, even to the western sea shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand against you. The Lord your God will put the dread of you and the fear of you upon all the land where you tread, just as he has said to you. How was it that Britain was able to send troops into India long time ago, subjugate a continent of people, and how was it their troops and soldiers could walk through the streets unmolested without being attacked or assaulted by the citizens of the land at one point in their history, and at another point routed and chased and defeated and sent home and reduced to a small military force. It's the blessing, it's the hand of God. It's where God puts his fear. Behold, I set before you today a blessing and a curse. The blessing if you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and the curse if you do not obey the commandments of the Lord your God, but turn aside from the way which I command you today to go after other gods which you have not known. Does God still put before his people a blessing and a curse? Of course he does. God has not changed. He's not working with us as he worked with national Israel in the land, but he is working with us in a very intimate way. Deuteronomy 12, verse 28. Observe and obey all these words which I command you, that it may go well with you and your children after you forever, when you do what is good and right in the sight of the Lord your God. Verse 32. Whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. You shall not add to it or take away. As I said, this is not just cause and effect, although I think obviously cause and effect is a very much a factor here. If you don't work, then you don't eat because you don't earn the money to pay the bills. Okay, that's cause and effect. But this is more than that. This is God saying, I will withhold the rain. I will bring the curse. I will make you bow your knee for your good, so that you might worship before me and remember that I am a great God, that I am the one who created you. And so with God's people, there is a factor in place there that goes beyond, again, cause and effect. And it goes right to God's hand and what he is doing with us. Deuteronomy 28, I won't read because we don't read that till Friday or Saturday, so I'll have to save that for a future sermon. But that's, again, a long chapter, 2 days to read it, very graphic on the blessings and the cursings. Again, God taking direct hand in working with his people. Obedience and disobedience affects our personal relationships. It affects our marriages. It affects our child rearing. It affects our finances. It affects our health. It affects everything that we think and do. If our life is not working, if it's not working, if some part of our life is empty or bare, then maybe it's not because we got struck by a meteor or because the polar ice shelves are melting. Maybe it is because we actually did something that removed God's blessing from our hands, and that has yet now then to be restored. We live in a society that teaches us, don't be judgmental, be accepting, diversity is everything is good, with no absolute standards. Therefore, sickness is just a chemical, not chemical, maybe chemical, maybe biological problem. That's all it is. It's just a biological issue. God says, I'll put none of these diseases on you. Now, again, we're in the New Testament. God allows us to be tried and tested. All sickness is not because of sin, but some of the sickness we have might be because of sin, even though it not be our own. If there's lead in the water and we drink it and we get sick, doesn't matter who put it in, we're sick. It's because of sin. And so sometimes it would be somebody else's sin. Sometimes it would be our own. Business failure, economic failure, relationship failure. Could we at least not consider what God's hand in those matters might be? If we be right and righteous in our action and we go before God and humble ourselves, then he would surely show his grace to us in that way. But if we indeed have participated in our own demise, would we not want God to show that to us as well? Would we not want to step out from underneath that curse that falls from a lack of God's blessing and grace in our hands? I mentioned 1 Corinthians 11 in the sermon I gave before I left, and it says, because you have not understood the body of Jesus Christ, you have not understood, it talks about taking the Passover, not understanding the meaning, the symbolism of the sacrifice, because God isn't protecting and guiding and caring for you, some of you are weak, some of you are sick, and some of you have died outside of God's intervention. And so, why should we live without being responsible for those things that we think and we say and we do? We have a society that tells us it's not our fault. We have a God that says, indeed, it is. In fact, if it's not our fault, why would we need to be forgiven? Why would Christ even have to die? If we couldn't help it, then it's not our fault. If we did it and we're responsible for it, then indeed the sacrifice of Jesus Christ discerning the body of Christ has the meaning it should have in the Passover, indeed, when we take it. Jeff Mayer was the doctor at camp this year. He's a good friend. He's been with rock climbing team in the past. And we were talking about some of these things, and he just said, look, life is too important to not check your focus every single day. It's too important. The stakes are too high to not stop and check your focus every single day. There's a parable in the Bible of the wheat and the tares, Matthew chapter 13. The parable shows that God is sowing wheat, or good fruit, and Satan is sowing tares, or weeds. Now, in the Bible context of the parable, it says, well, don't go rip out the tares because these are people, and you're going to tear out some of the wheat with them. Let them grow to the harvest, and God will sort the harvest out. But the tares and the weeds that Satan sows go beyond specific individuals. Satan is the prince of the power of the air, and the tares that he sows also enter his thoughts and attitudes and concepts into our own minds. Have you ever had any weeds pop up in your life? You're going along, and all of a sudden, here comes a dandelion, you know, right out into your mind, and there it sits. Where do you think those things come from? When I baptize someone, when they're preparing for baptism, I always warn them. I say, look, you can be assured that there will be an obstacle you're going to have to climb over to get to this point. Satan will test you. He will try to turn you aside. He'll get you to not attend. He'll turn you in some way where there's stress in your home. He'll cause a problem at work. There will be something where he is going to try to turn you back because he does not want to lose dominion. Set your jaw to obey God, something will come and strive to turn you back. It is almost a guarantee. It happens every single time. If we allow those weeds to establish themselves, just like in our gardens and just like in our yards and our fields, they will take over. Anybody know what liverwort is? Not the sandwich spread. Liverwort. It's a weed. It's a little flat green weed that looks kind of like a lichen that grows on the ground and real flat, and it doesn't really have roots. It has little tiny things that go down in the dirt that just kind of hold it in place, but they're not nutritionally feeding. It's roots that feeds on the surface of the leaves. And if you go to the nurseries around town, some of the nurseries, and look in their plants, they'll see some of these liverworts, little green flat things clumped up together in the pot. If you take that home and stick that in your garden and you don't get rid of that little green thing, your whole garden is going to look just like that spot in a matter of time. Now, I had some liverworts. They call them liverworts because herbal medicine has used them over the centuries to treat liver disease and to cleanse and strengthen the liver. I've never tried any, so I haven't actually had any liverwort tea or anything like that. But I got some into the garden at home in the front yard, and I thought they were kind of cute. They looked, you know, I had areas that hadn't filled in yet, and these things spread remarkably fast, and I thought, you know, they just bunch up right next to each other, and they'll form a mat of strict, just straight liverwort. You know, they'll just completely blanket the ground, and then they send up little tiny shoots. I had to look it up where exactly those shoots were called. They're called a sporophyte. And so this little arm comes up, a sporophyte, has a little ball on top. And how many spores do you think each plant sends out from that one little bump? How about 7 million? Now, I had no idea. 7 million spores going out from one. So I let them turn into a blanket, and there's thousands of them. And thousands of millions is more than, that's getting back to the budget crisis. And so I can't count that high. But I started noticing that they were taking over everything in the area. They were taking over the mosses. They were infiltrating the flower areas, and they were choking out the rest of the garden. And I said, well, this won't go. I'll have to get rid of them. And so I pulled them all up in buckets, hauled them across to the trash at the school because they had more room than we did, and they allowed me to do that, and hauled all these out and got rid of every single one I could find. And I assumed that if you just get these little things out of there before that spore comes up and the 7 million little beasts go running out in your garden, then you're okay. Just get them while they're getting growing up, and you'll be all right. Well, that was probably a couple of years ago, and we came home from camp this year, and I looked around, and here's Liverwort City, you know, scattering through my gardens again in the front, and I'm going, there's not a sporophyte. There's not a sporophyte in the garden. What is the problem? Why are these things still spreading? So I look up on the internet, and it says, oh, dear reader, don't even imagine that they need a spore to repopulate. If you break one off, that'll form a new plant. And if that doesn't work, they have a little tiny cup they form when they begin to grow that's called a gemma cup. And the gemma cup is full of, you guessed it, gemmas. And the gemmas, if you water the garden, will float up out of the cup and wash down the side of the hill and start all over again. You don't even need the 7 million spores. And it didn't say how many little gemma or gemmae were in this little cup, but it would wash down. And so I said, all right, you can't even let them grow up to teenagers. You got to get them out of there when they're little tiny babies and remove every single one. But it's hard to find every single one. When the Bible talks about Satan scattering tares, I think of liverworts now. And I just think that's what he does. There's no end to the thoughts. Is there ever a day when you don't have a thought that wanders into your mind that you have to say, I'm sorry, but that one will not be able to stay? If that stays, it's fertile. In fact, it will breed a whole host of affected material in my mind. There's a place on the way down to Kennewick that I would call Tumbleweed Alley. There's a valley that comes in from the right side as you're going down that funnels down to a smaller point, and then it kind of lifts up like it pushes across the freeway at that point. And at the right time of the year when the tumbleweeds are... Do you realize that God made the tumbleweeds to actually break off? I mean, he created them so that there'd be a weakness that would be built-in design at the base that when it dries out, it snaps so that it would roll and roll and roll. The first time they found tumbleweeds in this country was, when do you think, 500 years ago? Do you think the Indians had tumbleweed parties and stuff? You ever heard an Indian sing a song about tumbleweeds? No, it's the cowboys. The cowboys came later. 1877 was basically the introduction of tumbleweeds into the United States in South Dakota. Tumbleweeds are native. They're not supposed to be here. I don't think carp are supposed to be here. Thistles aren't supposed to be here. Tumbleweed's a type of thistle. It's called Russian thistle because it lives, its native habitat is in the Ural Mountains in Eurasia. And so what happened is apparently some of the farmers that had been from that area that moved to South Dakota are ordering in their flax seed from home, and in with it comes the tumbleweed seeds. And so they planted, 1877 was the first noticeable tumbleweed in this nation. How long do you think it took them to blow over and plant themselves on the Pacific Ocean? 1900. From 1877 to 1900, they were growing on the Pacific coast. I mean, the tumbleweed just went berserk. There are tumbleweeds now in Hawaii. Now, I don't know how they blew over there, but there's tumbleweeds in Hawaii. You know how many seeds are in a tumbleweed? You will never guess. One quarter of a million seeds in an average, normal, single tumbleweed. Quarter of a million. Satan is the prince of the power of the air, and he sows weeds in our minds. He sows weeds into our business system. He sows weeds into the churches of this land, into relationships, into child-rearing practices, into our language. When we go to camp at Challenger Camp, Mr. Lukey is right outside of the kitchen, has a pull-up bar. And every year they have a pull-up contest there. Mr. Lukey did 10 or 11. Greg Sargent, I think, did 14 or 15. He's older than I am. I waited till I got home, and I think I did 3. So I'm going to start working out on pull-ups. I don't know. It made me think, what am I doing climbing rocks if I can't do pull-ups? It kind of shocked me, but I didn't want to embarrass myself in front of the whole crowd, so I figured I'd practice first and see what I could do. But they have a pull-up bar there, and Mr. Lukey uses this concept, we're going to raise the bar. And so every year he ties the pull-up bar a little higher in the tree, but he uses that as an illustration. At camp, we're raising the bar. And so children come to teenagers, they're not fully adults, they come to an advanced camp, which is Challenger, which means you have to have already been somewhere else first. It means you're older, 15 to 19. It means you've had special approval somewhere in the church area by your minister, and you come to camp, and Mr. Lukey says, we still have to raise the bar when you get there. We have to get rid of some of the language. We have to get rid of some of the mannerisms, the way you deal with each other, some of the pranks and the joking. We have to change some of the habits of dress, more so for the girls. We need to cover up some of the skin. We issue t-shirts so that we don't have to fight anybody over what's appropriate and what's not, because it's all different everywhere you go. So here we have, in the church, some of the best kids in one of the best environments that's highly focused and controlled. And yet we still are raising the bar when they get there and when they're brought to us to try to send them back home better off than when they arrived. It's not just that we all need education, but it's because Satan has sowed weeds into our thoughts, into our speech, into our relationships. And unfortunately, when he sows millions of them, some of them take root. Who here has a garden that doesn't have a weed in it? I mean, it just probably doesn't happen. It's a constant battle to root them out. We cannot allow what Satan sows to grow into harvest. Look at Deuteronomy 5, going back a little further. Verse 29. Moses showing again the giving of the law, reminding the people now before they go into the land of Canaan what God has given them to do. But in verse 29, Deuteronomy 5, oh, that they had such a heart in them that they would fear me and always keep all my commandments, that it might be well with them and with their children forever. There's cause and effect. You let the liverworts go and they take over the whole front yard. It's diligent effort to get rid of them, but if you'll plant in its place while they're gone, before they establish themselves, if you will plant moss or ground cover or mulch or a covering plant to fill that up, then they cannot return. And so there is a way to counteract them naturally and appropriately in the garden. But you have to have something else take over and become dominant in its place. And so at camp, we're trying to encourage the removal of the weeds and the fertile planting of God's wheat, as he describes it, and the refreshment of the Holy Spirit. And God says, when you do that, it brings to you a blessing. It's cause and effect, but it's more than natural, it's supernatural, because it's by God's own hand. Look at the opening to the book of Psalms, Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water, that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. Now I realize this is poetic, and it doesn't mean that no matter what you do, you can't fail, but it's speaking of a principle of God's blessing on our hands and in our minds and our thoughts. The ungodly are not so. They're like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish, and God will direct it consciously by his hand. We have a code of honor that applies to all the church camps, all the youth church camps of United. And there's a checklist, and they go through, and the very first thing on the checklist when they fill out an application is ask if the code of honor has been read by the recipient. And then you have to sign off the application that you accept these things, that you agree with these principles. Every year, campers show up who don't accept these things and agree with these principles. They just sign on because that's what you're supposed to do. That's what you have to do to beat the system. You got to get there, and then it'll be all right. But God says, if you'll obey me, I'll bless you. If you won't, I'll take it away. As a United Youth camper, I will follow and respect the following code of honor. I won't read all of it, but I'll read part of it. Strive to behave as a representative of Christ and represent God in an honorable manner. And it gives scriptures as it goes through. Keep the Ten Commandments. Honor God's Sabbath day. Avoid inappropriate Sabbath activities. Yeah, I was talking with a minister some time ago, and we were discussing some issues, and I said, well, look, camp has a set of standards that camp operates by. Why can't we use those same standards just for the church? Why should the children, the teenagers, have a set of standards at camp, but then they go back home and there's a different set of standards and there's permission to do this here but not permission to do it there? I said, why can't there just be a standard that we agree to that is proper and godly? And why can't it be a standard that applies to all? Follow the no-knock policy, which is, I will not criticize, make fun of, ridicule, exclude, or put down others. And I have to work on that. I joke about things at times that aren't funny. And I'm reminded, and I appreciate, if I ever joke about something, and I have on occasion in the congregation that's not funny, and you all don't laugh, I appreciate that. Because that's a kind of a check and a balance on, that really wasn't funny. I remember sitting in Pasadena during the receivership, listening to certain individuals on the auditorium stage ranting and raving and making fun of people's names in the state administration and mocking people and watching the audience just roar with approval. And I remember sitting there with my friends looking at each other as, what in the world has gone wrong here? This is the church. And we would sit there and people were just loving it, eating it up, mocking and making fun and criticizing and ridiculing. I appreciate that there is back pressure on each of us in a right and proper way. Some of these have to do more with the camp environment. This is interesting. Observe the dorm lights out and quiet time, because at Challenger Camp, that's 10 o'clock in the park as a whole. One night we went to bed, 10:30, 11 o'clock, and there's a campsite down the road, and there's just roar coming out of this campfire, and people were getting up and making comments, and everybody was applauding and yelling, and I just said, what is wrong with this? And I got up and went down there by myself, and there's a whole big group by the campfire, and I said, well, I don't know if I want to walk in there by myself. So I walked back to camp and got another staff member, and the two of us went down, and we met somebody coming out of the campsite, and we said, look, you know, 10 o'clock is quiet, and you're keeping the entire camp up. We have kids up there that can't get to sleep. And the man said, "Oh, I'm really sorry." Turns out they were a group of Mormons that were there on a camp out. And you know how long it took them to quiet down? About 2 minutes. And that whole place was dead silent. The minute you told them there was a problem and they recognized it, they corrected it. And you know what that made me think of the Mormons? As a social instrument, as a neighbor, as a social friend, it lifted and elevated them in my eyes immediately. I mean, the minute they realized there was a problem, they shut it down. Now, we had on the other side of this a couple times Boy Scouts. I love the Boy Scouts. Derek was a Boy Scout. I think the Boy Scouts have been under attack by those trying to liberalize social agenda in this nation, and I feel that they should hold their ground. So I really have a favorable impression of the Boy Scouts. But we had Boy Scouts running through our areas, yelling, hooping, hollering, screaming, playing fun at night, and they didn't have that same kind of control, and it actually depreciated my impression of the scouting and the ability to take those boys and direct them in a right and proper way. Now that's how this works. God says, obey me. It's cause and effect in the community, but it's cause and effect by God's own direct hand. A couple more comments here. Refer to older married staff as Mr. and Mrs. and use the last name. Respect my counselor. I said, I promise to respect my counselor, assistant counselor, and other camp staff and follow their instructions. Treat campers with respect, dignity, and a positive attitude. And some other areas here. Observe the code of no practical jokes at camp. There's no place for practical jokes at camp. Get it carried away. To show you how serious an issue this is and how important it is, and especially, you know, when you're out on a canoe going down through the rapids, when you're up on the rocks climbing and you're sitting there on a rope, or when you're sitting on the edge of a cliff where we actually climb, and if you just walked over 10 feet, you could drop off and fall for great distance. The top of our rappel station is 60 feet off the ground, and people sit on the edge of that and take pictures. So, I mean, anytime somebody gave a little bump or a joke or a pop, you know, someone could be hurt right now. One of the campers took one of the staff members' shoes that were sitting outside of his tent and tied them together and threw them up in a tree one night. And the staff member didn't know what had happened, and he just simply asked for an announcement and asked if anybody knew where the shoes were. And you know, it was a funny thing, but you could look through the crowd and you could figure out who knew something and who didn't. Maybe not in every case, but basically Mr. Lukey was able to say, so-and-so, what do you know about this? Well, I don't know, maybe not much. Well, why don't you tell us what you do know? Well, we did it. You know what the penalty at Challenger Camp is for we did it on something like that? You're going home. I don't care, $500, extra plane ticket, you're going home. Now, the campers involved asked, showed contrition, decided that they didn't want to have such a severe penalty brought on them for what was such a prank, simple thing. I mean, we do this in school all the time. It doesn't mean anything at home. And so Mr. Lukey allowed them to make a public apology in the morning to the entire camp for having disrupted what we were trying to accomplish at camp and for showing disrespect to the staff. And he allowed them to finish out the last day with activities and go home on schedule because they showed that kind of contrition. As we sat down and talked to them, one of the campers said to me, well, before you, this is before decisions were made as to what the penalty would be. He said, well, I know this maybe doesn't count, but before you decide what to do, I'd like to maybe tell you what my background is like. I said, fine, you go ahead and tell me, and then I'll tell you what my background is like. What does what your background is like have to do with choosing to throw a pair of shoes up in a tree? It has nothing. But this society says, you've had a bad life. We don't expect you to be responsible. You can drive a car and you can turn right if the arrow says right, and if the stop sign says stop, you stop, but you can't expect to be, you know, held accountable for the way you treat another person. That's hogwash. It's irresponsibility. We do these things that we do. Satan might indeed encourage us. It might be an accelerator that's put in that equation that causes us great desire and temptation. We may be thoughtless and inconsiderate, but we are still responsible for what we do. God says, if they would have a heart to obey me, then I would bless them. I would turn and bless them again. The last one here says, wear appropriate apparel at all times. Again, some of the girls coming into camp arrived with what was considered to be improper clothing, and they had to be asked to remove that and put on something else. Why do they even come? Who let them get on the plane in the first place? There's a parent somewhere, or there's a parent nowhere, that has allowed that process to take place. We are responsible for our families and the circumstances they live and work and survive and function in. As I said, at the end of every day, we sat around the campfire, Christian living, question and answer. There was one question that really troubled me when it came up, when I saw what the answers were. You know, by and large, we're talking very highly motivated teenagers here. Cream of the crop, very responsive. If you're canoeing, you're canoeing hard. You're climbing hard. You're packing, you're packing. I mean, they're working. They want to be there. They know there's only 60 kids get to go every year. There's a limit. There's a cutoff. And if you get in the door, that's a blessing. And so they're motivated and they do well. And if you tell them to do something, they respond to it. But they still come out of this world where all of those tares have been sown and blown around and filtered in, and some of those tares filter right into their own lives. There was a question that one of the ministers asked the campers one evening. He says, well, what is it? What is it that in your life that makes it hardest for you to obey God, to stay faithful to God, to keep focused on God? What is it that pulls you the strongest? And they began to go around, and different campers answered in different ways. But do you know what the common denominator of their answers, what that was? The common denominator was, it's because of my friends. Now, some said, well, you know, my friends say this, and then you try not to say those things like they say them. And some said, my friends do this, and I don't want to do that, and they want me to do it, and then they want to do something on the Sabbath. Or they, you know, they're all saying, well, my friend, and I just couldn't believe it. And so they went all around, and I finally raised my hand, and I said, well, I have to ask. Then why do we have these friends? And so the next answer responses we got were kind of defensive. Well, you do the best you can, was one comment. You know, there's bad kids in the church, was another comment. Well, we're not supposed to hate people. We're supposed to be friendly. So I raised my hand again. I said, all right, I accept. We know. God says, love your enemies. We're to be kind, gracious, courteous. We're to give a good example. I know we all agree on those things. I don't think that is in dispute. I said, I don't think maybe then you understood or heard my question. Maybe I wasn't clear. My question is, and I ask again, then why do we have these friends? And then a girl raised her hand and said, well, for my part, basically, I guess I just want to be accepted. I want to be accepted by the people that I have contact with. I don't want to be singled out or picked on. I don't want to be seen as a goody-goody. And so the fact is I compromise in order to be with people that don't have values or support the values that I myself want to have. And I just didn't want to raise my hand again because it broke my heart to sit and hear teens in the church say, well, really, you know, actually, they're not that good of friends. And they really don't have that good of values. And they are what it is that causes me the most temptation and trial to stay faithful to God and the church and to do His will and to obey His commands and to keep the Sabbath. It is my friends that I have chosen to be with that caused me the greatest distress. It was distressing to me to hear that given as an answer. Do you know what else they were saying that they didn't say? Which I'll just, what I would read behind that. I would say they are also saying that my parents frankly don't care enough to make the distinction and to require any different of me. My parents don't care enough to make me make a different kind of decision than that. Now maybe there's somebody not in the church, maybe there's somebody who is. Maybe there's somebody who's signed off, overworked, stressed out. Fine. There's always a reason for a problem. Is there a justification for sin? There is not. Somewhere along the line, there were parents who frankly, simply didn't care enough to require of those teens to make those kind of proper decisions. Now, I don't hold up anything that we strive or struggle to do as somehow having solved the problem. You have heard the problems of my life detailed in sermons for 5.5 years, and I don't think I would hopefully have not tried to hide the fact of what I have come through and tried to work towards and struggle still with. I am not up here somehow just speaking to everyone but myself. But Megan is in a horse environment by choice, not because it's economic, not because it's good and reasonable, but because there's an environment there that is conducive to picking a peer group that will do positive things. So we went, Michelle did, took her to the closest 4-H chapter to our house and sat down and joined when this process began. And she looked around and decided that the atmosphere in the 4-H group that she was in was not conducive to what our little girl, what we wanted her to be. And what the parents allowed and tolerated was not conducive to what we wanted our little girl to be. And so she picked her up out of that 4-H and took her to another one. Now we're driving all the way north of town. And she sat in that 4-H for a while and looked around and found again, for different reasons, not necessarily the same, that that wasn't exactly, again, the peer group and the association and the opportunities that we wanted her to have and what we wanted her to be. So she took her to a third one, which is now clear out here in the valley, which is a long ways from where we live, looking for a place to park our daughter where the parents and the children, where the children were children, the parents cared, and where there was responsibility to put in place. And so that's where she has stayed. Since that time, one of the girls in the first group now is pregnant, and another girl who joined that group after we left is dead. From hot rodding, very unfortunate circumstance, but a rowdy circumstance, inappropriate, has lost her life. Now, what is it worth to have friends who are not going to reinforce, support the values of what we believe in? When the little boy who Derek runs with, who spends half his time at our house sleeping, and Derek spends half the time at his house sleeping, who is not in the church, comes to our house, he does not use euphemisms for God or cursing or any other thing. Why? Because I've had to explain it to him. You cannot be Derek's intimate, close friend. You can be friendly, but you cannot be there around him all the time and in our home unless you accept that there's a certain environment that has to be maintained. I don't expect him to keep the Sabbath. I don't expect him to have our value system. I expect him to simply have a minimum standard of social propriety and etiquette in order to be an intimate friend. It was very distressing to me to hear some of the finer teenagers in the church saying, well, we just have to compromise with these things. There really isn't any other way. I don't think we should compromise with those things. I think we should stand up and represent who we represent, and yes, be friendly, courteous, loving, help, share, contribute, do all those things. Christ did all those things. But I do not think we should step aside from what God has given us to do. Proverbs 22. I mean, where will it end? You would not have wanted your children to be my friend when I was growing up. I would not have been a good influence on them. So I don't hold that up in any way. You would have wanted to go and surely do something else. Proverbs 22 and verse 24. Make no friendship with an angry man, and with a furious man do not go, lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Fine, change anger to anything you want. Covetous, thieving, vicious, lying. Make no friendship with such a man. And we're not talking about being friendly, we're talking about becoming intimate, build a relationship. Get in there close to where you impact each other in terms of the personality and the approach that you take. Lest you learn his ways and set a snare for your soul. Proverbs 27, verse number 6. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. So even if you were accepted in the crowd and you have the kisses of those people, it's deceitful, because it is not going to necessarily be for purity or for godliness or for righteousness that that relationship takes place. Better to have a friend say, "Don't you do that again." No, frankly, I didn't think that was funny. That's why I didn't laugh. And I don't think you should think that was funny either. We can say it nicely, courteously, but there ought to be a back pressure. Friendship ought to be something, intimate friendship ought to be something that pushes us, directs us, nudges us closer to God and His ways, not something that pulls us back out and causes us in some way to withdraw. You see, Roger Babson, he was right. When the righteousness of the people is predominant, then there will be increase in prosperity, and there will be opportunity, and there will be blessing. And when the righteousness of the people declines, there will be a collapse. Let not a collapse of the society around us sow in any way weeds into us such that there be a collapse in us as well. Let us indeed raise that bar. Our speech, our thoughts, our relationships, our manners, the courtesy and the love that we show and care for each other, let us raise that bar and let the righteousness of God's people indeed represent that this is indeed a way that God has given us, the way of God.